And if you'll look around to your left, you'll see me and the most famous aviator in the world, Mr. Robert A. Hoover. Have a seat, Bob.
Donnie, thank you very much. And folks, I'm so pleased to say hello to you and delighted to be here and watch the growth one more year at EAA.
Bob, you've been here many, many times, and I want to get your impression. What does EAA mean to you personally?
Well, I have to back up a little bit. Paul Pobrezny was in the Air Guard, and he was flying F-86s. And I was performing, demonstrating the airplane. I went all around the Air Force and every country in the world that had the airplane, put on demonstrations and gave safety lectures. And Paul told me about organizing EAA, and he lived over in Hales Corners, not too far from the Milwaukee airport, and he invited me over to his house. And so I saw the birthplace of EAA. It was in his basement, and it was a furnace and a coal bin, and he made a small little room separate from those, and he had a desk and a chair. And that was the embryonic stage of EAA. And he told me of this vision, and he's made his dream come true. Look what's happened. Every year it's now international, and I seem to be able to go anywhere in the world and somebody will come up and say, I'm a member of EAA. Well, I know I've got a friend, and that's just what it's all about, being with people who like flying, enjoy it, and sharing your experiences. And the Pobrezny family dedicated their lives to making this a success, and I just want to pay that tribute to that family. Thank you.
Thank you, Bob. I just wonder, how many foreign guests do we have here? How many people are not U.S. citizens? Raise your hands. Thank you so much. I flew 40 Australians in the B-17 the other day, Bob. One afternoon, 40. And I said, how many people from Australia here? And he said, 450. So you're correct. EA is an international organization, a great thing. Let's go back.
Well, let me pick up something there. Many of you know that I was grounded for 3 years falsely. Yeah. And during that three-year period, I was under contract to go over to Australia and start the first national air races. In Australia, and it occurred in Tasmania, which is an island off of Australia's coast there. And the people treated me royally. I was grounded in the U.S., and someone called me and said, since you're coming over to Australia, why don't you get the Australian medical certificate out of the way there in Los Angeles? And I thought it was one of the show people, one of the producers, and he said, there's a Dr. Marinelli over right at LAX across the field from your office, and he said, go over and see him, and he's going to let you write in and give you the physical. And he's assigned to do that from our government over here, so he's one of us. And so I went over and visited with this fellow, and he said, boy, do you know people in high places? And I said, what do you mean? He said, do you know who you were talking to? And I said, well, I haven't any idea. I thought it was one of the people putting on the air show over there. And he said, no. He said, he's like the federal air surgeon in Australia, the number one medical doctor, and he was also in charge of certification, both pilots and aircraft. Well, here I couldn't fly in the United States, so I seem to have been adopted by the Australians. And I could fly. They had an airplane just like the one I was flying, and the owner was just tickled to death to have me fly it. And he would have it anywhere in Australia that people were putting on event. And so I flew somebody else's airplanes over there. So the second trip, I decided I would put an Australian flag on the other shoulder. I had the American flag here on my flights. Well, they seemed to like me all the more for wearing that flag. And each time I'd be interviewed, and they had a lot of TV coverage, I'd point to that Australian flag. And it was heartwarming to me. They treated me so royally and meant first class. It was just beyond my realization. But I felt that was my adopted country.
The Sound of Freedom. I have a copy of Bob's book, Forever Flying, which is available over in the merchandise area here after the presentation, and he will be there to sign copies for you if you'd like. But I'd like to read out of the first page here. It says, "Ladies and gentlemen, let me introduce to you Bob Hoover, the greatest stick and rudder pilot alive today." No, that's wrong. "Let me introduce you to Bob Hoover, the greatest stick and rudder pilot who ever lived. General James Doolittle, 1988. Now, how did you get to that point? How did you become so damn good?
I'm sure that each of you had someone who influenced your life or desire to fly. And as a youngster, I went through a lot of obstacles. I was air sick, I overcame that, had bad eyes, and a very great doctor said, "Young man, I've watched you fly, and this is ridiculous that you can't fly because of your eyes." And I said, "You mean I'm not going to be able to be a military pilot?" He said, "Well, I've got some business in my office, and you just stay here, but you better be able to read the second line from the bottom." When I returned, well, boy, that old memory bank started looking at those letters, and he came in and he said, "Now, you passed the test, but any time they wish to dilate your pupils, you tell them that you have an allergy to it and you get sick and you can't have your eyes dilated. Now you can become a fighter pilot wearing thick-rimmed glasses," but back then you couldn't. And he kept following my career, and after the war he called me and he said, "Just think, I feel responsible for your successes." I said, "You are the only person responsible." But what kind of a pal? His name was Robert Patterson from Nashville, Tennessee, and I'll always remember that.
How did you draw an instructor from your hometown? That's pretty lucky.
Well, I joined the Air Guard at 18, and I was too young to go to flight training, but I already knew how to fly, knew aerobatics, and when I joined the Air Guard, all of the airplanes had dual controls. It was an observation squadron with O-47s, which was a pot-bellied North American airplane. It seated three people for observation work, and we had a few Douglas O-38s, which were biplanes with a big engine, and numerous other types of airplanes. And the storm clouds were building up over Europe, and this was long before Pearl Harbor, and they decided we were going to have to increase our pilot resources, and they lowered the age from 21 to 18 and eliminated the two-year college requirement. And the commanding officer called me in and he said, "All you have to do is take the written exam and you won't have any trouble with that, and I'll make you a second lieutenant. And the pilots tell me you're qualified," because they were all dual controlled and they knew how eager I was to fly, so they would let me have some stick time and let me even take off and land. And so he said, "You aren't going to have any problem, and you'll get to do what you really want to do." And I said, "Sir, I can't thank you enough. But if I do that, I'll have this O in my shield of my wings, and I cannot fly combat. And I want to be a fighter pilot more than anything in the world. Could you get me an assignment to go to military flight training school?" And he said, "Well, of course. Doesn't make any difference whether you do this or that. But he said, I hate to lose you." And I said, "Well, I'm so grateful that you feel that way, sir." I said, "But I want to be a fighter pilot." Well, I got to primary, and if you can imagine this, the instructor was giving me an orientation flight, and he didn't know that I knew anything about flying. And so he finished up showing me all the locations around the airfield, training field, and he said, "Would you like to see a roll?" And I said, "Yes, sir." And so he did a roll, and he dished out of it. And he said, "Would you like to try one?" And he shook his head, and he said, "Where did you learn how to do that?" And I said, "I taught myself. There was nobody, there was no instructors that knew anything about aerobatics." And he said, "What else can you do?" And I said, "I can do a four-point roll." And I said, "The secret is you don't want to dish out. And so you dive down, let's say 2,000 feet is the ground on your altimeter. And so you don't go below 2,000 feet no matter what you do. And then you start the maneuver, depending upon your angle of attack, because the rate of roll slows down as you go over." And so I demonstrated a four-point roll, an eight-point roll, and loops. And we came back in, and he was shaking his head. And he went over to the commandant's office, and he said, "I've got a problem with one of my students." And the commandant said, "Well, just wash him out." And he said, "Sir, you don't understand. He can fly better than me or any pilot we've got here as instructors." And he said, "Well, what do you suggest I do?" And he said, "Give him a check ride with the other instructors and let him show them how to really fly the airplane." Well, now that sounds great, but here's the reality. I went to basic training, and I had to learn instruments. And it was the most difficult thing in the world for me, because all of my experience had been by the seat of the pants, just what you see and what you feel. And now I've got to play those instruments. And I had a desperate time getting adjusted to that. And I finally made it, thank goodness. And I'm so glad I did for the rest of my life. It helped me immensely. I've been in some tight situations in weather, and I don't like it, but I've survived it. And anyway, that was the beginning of my career.